welcome back to The Civic Flame, a podcast where we take a deep dive into the U.S. Constitution and look at how it is, and is not, shaping the U.S. government today. I'm Amber, a professor of law and policy at Worcester State University, and today we're going to walk through some key features of the Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights is the first 10 amendments to the U.S. Constitution, and it covers a lot about what we call due process. That is, the process the government owes everyone who interacts with it. Now, usually, we do the amendments and sections in order, but today, we're going to do it a little bit differently. Because Amendments 6 and 7 both deal with lawyers, we're actually going to talk about 5 and 8 today, and leave 6 and 7, 6-7 for those parents of middle schoolers out there, for next week. Grab your stress blankets, and let's go. As we've talked about before, the Bill of Rights is really a bill of civil liberties. The fundamental difference is that if it's a right, the government has to make sure you have access to something. If it's a liberty, all they have to do is stay out of your way. Due process is a liberty, that is a freedom from the government. Why? Well, let's talk about it. The Fifth Amendment says, "No person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on presentment or indictment of a grand jury, except in cases arising in the land or naval forces, or in the militia when in actual service in time of war or public danger, nor shall any person be subject for the same offense to be twice put in jeopardy of life or limb, nor shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself, nor be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation." Now, this amendment's doing a little bit of heavy lifting. Notice buried in here, you see that you cannot be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Yeah? Well, that's a big deal, because it means that with due process of law, the government can take your property, they can put you in jail, they can even kill you. So it's kind of a big deal. So what does due process require? Well, you have lots of issues. We started last time with the Fourth Amendment, which talked about search and seizure and how evidence against you can be gathered. Today, we get issues about right to a trial. You get the presentment or indictment of a grand jury. Now, those of you who watch lawyerly shows like Law & Order or She-Hulk, you're familiar with regular juries or small petit juries. These juries are the ones that hear a single case and determine the guilt or not guilt of whomever. A grand jury is a larger jury. They don't hear the case as you would think of it. They meet over the course of sometimes several months, and they hear from a prosecutor. The prosecutor gives them evidence, suggests charges, and calls upon them to determine whether or not there looks like there's enough evidence to bring charges against someone. So this starts out with meaning that you need to have some level of evidence against you before charges are brought and gets your case into the legal system. This takes a lot of different forms, and there are nuances by state and federal government. And there can be differing involvement by judges and other legal actors. But for that, you'll need to go to the first year of law school and take criminal and civil procedure. Next, some cases are pretty important and talk about things like double jeopardy. This essentially means you can't be tried for the same crime twice. Now, this is where my students ask if I've ever heard of the O.J. Simpson trial, and my bones literally turn to dust because, yes, I watched all of that in high school. But this case comes up because O.J. was found not guilty in the criminal trial, and then there was a civil trial for which he was found liable. This is something we'll get into next time when we talk about lawyers. Amendment 6 has to do with criminal trials, and Amendment 7 has to do with civil trials. But here's the thing. Since it's two different crimes, civil and criminal, that means it's not actually the same crime twice. This question also comes up with mistrials, particularly high-profile cases like the Karen Reed cases. Ultimately, there's a very high threshold to prove that it was a mistrial. And if it's a mistrial, it basically doesn't count. You can bring similar charges again, not to be counted under double jeopardy. But because they're so close to double jeopardy, the standard there on deciding not only that something is a mistrial, but you can also have a follow-up trial is pretty high. Because we have 50 different states with 50 different legal systems, and a federal government. This may vary wildly by where you live and your interactions with the system, but this is kind of the basic template, and everybody else pulls from there. But as we discuss in the next two amendments, civil law and criminal law have some important differences, and one of those is in the burden of proof. The civil trial burden of proof is a preponderance of evidence, meaning that it has to look more likely that you did it than not. With criminal law, it has to be beyond a reasonable doubt, meaning there can be no doubt from a reasonable person that you are guilty. So next comes the section you're most likely familiar with, which is you cannot be compelled, in a criminal case, to be a witness against yourself. The Fifth Amendment was one of the key components of the famous Miranda v. Arizona case. Miranda is decided in 1966 during the midst of the Warren Court, the only court we've had in U.S. history that was particularly liberal, and the result is what we know of today as your Miranda rights. Among these include, you have the right to remain silent. Anything you say or do can be used against you in a court of law. You have a right to an attorney. If you cannot afford one, one will be appointed to you. Do you understand these rights? Couple of things here. Do you understand these rights? This is important because if you need to understand them for them to apply, the lawyer stuff we'll get into next week, but the rest about the right to remain silent include your protections from self-incrimination. So remember, kiddos, what do we say when we are in police custody? Nothing, not a dang thing, until your lawyer was present. Cases have come up since, trying to explain at what point these protections kick in factually. Typically, the court has decided it is during custodial interrogation, or whenever you are in police custody officially. This means that if the police stop you and ask you a question, your Miranda rights might not kick in automatically, because you're not technically in custody. So you want to ask if you're being detained. If you're being detained, then you can for sure invoke your rights. But that's another one where the nuance is for the real lawyers. But last is about property being taken without just compensation. Some of these questions about eminent domain come under here. Sometimes the government needs to acquire private property, but they're supposed to be required to pay you justly for it. This came up a lot during the railroad cases in the 1800s. Today, I would imagine we're going to see that come up more with data centers. Remember, AI and other large-scale computer generation systems really rely on a lot of power and water, and states around the country have been saying no to data centers in their area or on their farms. There are legal ways to make these places less extractive, right? Like, we could demand all new data centers put solar panels on their buildings and their parking lots and do other things to make them at least neutral on the power grid. We don't, but this is a way to make them more affordable for local communities. Because remember, at least one of the reasons a lot of our water and electric bills are high is because these companies use our resources and often don't pay or don't pay fairly or don't pay taxes. But even if we sort out the power issue, there's still the water issue. Data centers require tons of water to cool them. This is where the eminent domain argument might come up more closely in the future. So there's all sorts of rights here about the ways in which the government can coerce you or your stuff. While the Fourth Amendment outlines how evidence against you can be gathered, and the Fifth discusses what process you get when it is, the Eighth Amendment covers what happens if you do go to jail. The Eighth Amendment says, excessive bail shall not be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishment inflicted. This one gets a bit controversial when it comes to things like what counts as excessive bail or excessive fines. There are many ways in our system where fines are excessive for petty criminal acts like theft or drugs, but not nearly enough for civil acts like Purdue Pharma being almost single-handedly responsible for the opioid epidemic, or Johnson & Johnson selling cancer-causing baby powder that, while it has led to billions in potential fines, is still not enough. Whenever you think about what inequality looks like, you want to look at these spots where things are treated differently. And it's pretty sharp when it comes to the Eighth Amendment, because our criminal justice system applies differently to poor people than wealthy people, and to crimes more likely committed by poor people than crimes more likely to be committed by wealthy people or organizations. See also the Epstein files. In 1901 or so, Clarence Darrow, at the time one of the most famous lawyers in the country, gave an address to the prisoners of the Cook County Jail where he said, "You're in jail because you're poor." And while he's a prison abolitionist and I'm not, he had some solid points on that one. I highly recommend checking it out. I'll talk about it again a little bit next week. The other issue that comes up with the Eighth Amendment is cruel and unusual punishment. First question, does it have to be cruel and unusual, or cruel or unusual? This is an interesting question, because at the time of the writing of the Constitution, you could do things like brand people and put them in the stocks. So it would be considered unusual under an originalist reading of the Constitution to brand somebody? Can we do it? I say yes for people who commit crimes against children, but the criminal justice system says no. But the unusual part is one place where even a lot of originalist justices do seem to have their legal theory at the door. But what do we do about the death penalty? This is the place where a lot of folks engage in disagreement. Around the U.S., states have very different positions on the death penalty, but the federal government does allow it. Most similarly situated countries don't have the death penalty, and many won't extradite criminals back to the U.S. if they're going to face it. But states don't really have that power. Remember that Article 4 thing about full faith and credit and so on? It basically requires states to extradite criminals back to other states, but it can't do anything about the international order. Is the death penalty cruel? Maybe. Is it unusual? Not really. So what exactly does the Eighth Amendment say about it? Well, it's unclear. But if you go to the Innocence Project, they have plenty to say, including that, aside from legal questions, there have been a lot of innocent people murdered by the state. So that should certainly give us some pause. On that unhappy note, next week we'll be getting into how you, hopefully, stay out of these situations in the first place. Lawyers. As we work through the Bill of Rights and the 14th Amendment, hopefully you'll have a fuller understanding of your rights and the government's obligation to respect those rights, something I feel like we always need to remind the government about. In the meantime, follow us on Blue Sky and Instagram, and like and share widely. Take care out there, and keep the civic flame burning bright. The Civic Flame is a Dr. Fun Sponge Media project with writer Amber Veo and sound producer Matthew Munyon. Thanks for listening.